if you want to understand how Donald Trump operates and does this big distraction palooza every day, page 6.
Exactly.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always. Glad you joined us today on the Lincoln Square Network. And we are so delighted to be joined today by the author of a tremendous new book called The Gods of New York by Jonathan Mahler. And he has written a profile of a time and a place in New York that has shaped our history more than we have thought. It's about the big players, the big game in New York City, and in some ways, how Donald Trump emerged from that big game and how it was covered at the time. So, Jonathan, tell us about Gods of New York. Talk to us about what led you to write this book, and walk us through some of the formative things that you know about our current president that you learned in reporting this.
Yeah, sure. So this book actually kind of grew out of my work in 2016 on the 2016 presidential campaign. My day job is at the New York Times. I was working on the campaign. I wasn't following a specific candidate, but I was doing kind of deeper dives into the histories of some of the candidates, because I'd written a previous book about New York, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, which is about New York in the 70s. I was kind of especially interested in the Trump origin story.
Before he was a presidential candidate,
and I've been saying for years, keep the oil, don't let him have the oil.
Before he was a reality TV star,
you're fired.
Donald Trump was a New York tabloid fixture. All through the 1980s, Trump was busy building something new, and it wasn't a skyscraper.
Billionaire developer Donald Trump has put his name on a New York City hotel, shopping center, and apartment buildings, as well as a casino in Atlantic City. And now he's going to put his name on a big piece of Eastern Airlines.
Trump was creating a public persona, one that could be both funny and demeaning, arrogant and somehow in touch with the common man.
I sort of love and hate him at the same time. I mean, I think he has, you know, a monumental ego.
He comes off as being very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Arrogant?
Yeah, he's arrogant.
I like him.
You do?
Man's got a maid, got everything.
He often did this by picking fights.
He said, I think Donald Trump is an artful liar. I think he is a greedy, vicious, and arrogant man.
Well, I don't know, is that supposed to be a compliment or not? I'm not sure.
Donald Trump in 1980s New York. So I kind of got into my research sort of through those stories, really discovered that period of time was just like both like kind of a fascinating period filled with these outsized characters. I mean, Donald Trump, of course, but also Al Sharpton, Spike Lee, Larry Kramer, Rudy Giuliani, the list goes on. So I had these kind of big characters and this kind of crazy period of time in the life of New York with all these big racial incidents, Black Monday.
As the Dow Jones Industrials took off on a fear-fed freefall to close down a record 508.32 points, panicked traders worked through lunch hours in a desperate but losing attempt to keep up with tickers that rolled up an all-time high volume. CBS News business correspondent Ray Brady looks at this devastating day for the market.
They're calling it the Monday Massacre, the worst drop in Wall Street history.
I just came from inside and it looks like a madhouse.
It's so crazy, nobody even expected it to be down this much.
Hour after hour today, wave after wave of selling hit the stock market. A selling panic, the professionals call it. By the closing bell, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was in the steepest fall in its 103-year history, down more than 500 points.
I also came to see this as a really kind of important moment, kind of an inflection point in the life of the city and kind of ultimately in the life of America, because this is really when kind of Wall Street and finance and real estate sort of took over the city, when the city kind of reoriented its economy around those forces. And it was when, you know, Donald Trump kind of rose up from kind of from the ashes of the fiscal crisis in 1970s New York, you know, built the Trump Tower.
The tallest concrete building in the city of New York.
I think this is a first-rate project, 68 stories. And now the toast.
May these walls withstand the winters of endless years. May all who dwell within know only happiness. And may the windows of this building forever look out upon a place of peace and prosperity.
Congratulations. Very nice. Thank you. Very nice. Very, very nice.
By the way, he is a chip off the old block.
This is my father, Fred.
Right, who has done a remarkable job on behalf of the 7.5 million New Yorkers. You're bringing in a lot of money into the city, and that helps us deliver services.
And we congratulate Don Trump today.
Thank you very much, Coy. I appreciate it. We've employed 5,000 construction workers. There'll be many people employed in running the building, and I think it's a very important step for New York. I think it's a vital step for New York.
Anytime.
We're going to release 10,000 balloons, so have a good time.
Humiliated Ed Koch every chance he got.
He waged a years-long battle with New York City Mayor Ed Koch.
I hope that New York City has a different mayor at some point, because I think Ed Koch is a total disaster. He's been a very bad mayor for the city.
Ed Koch has been a disaster as a mayor. You know it, I know it, everybody knows it.
I would say he's got no talent and only moderate intelligence. What Ed Koch has is nothing. The man has not got it.
Ed Koch has been a lousy mayor. I believe he'll go down as probably in history the worst mayor in the history of the city of New York. And, you know, when I say that, it's hard for him to say, I really like Donald Trump.
I want to make it very clear. I'm very biased. I don't like him.
You know, I think that, you know, kind of maybe most important is, you know, people, I think, often consider The Apprentice to be the kind of origin story of Donald Trump, right? People think about that as where Donald Trump began.
In January 2004, The Apprentice premiered. At first, Trump didn't realize what a phenomenon the show would be.
The new reality TV series The Apprentice brings together 20 ambitious contestants hoping to survive in New York's corporate jungle. Donald Trump and Mark Burnett, good morning. Nice to see you guys.
Hello, Katie.
Why?
I have absolutely no idea, but...
But The Apprentice was a giant hit.
You're fired!
And when the season ended in April, Trump was ascending to new heights.
At a bar in Chicago, the hometown of The New Apprentice, it sounded as loud as a Cubs victory party.
The Apprentice portrayed Donald Trump in the most flattering possible light. As the host of the show, Trump came across like an able commander, a morally strong but fair leader, and a tycoon who couldn't fail.
Doesn't it?
You know, I've always got a lot of attention. This is getting a little ridiculous, and
oh,
I had
please.
No idea it was going to do this.
You love it. Come
well.
On.
Katie,
don't get started
me
with me.
Be nice to
I discovered doing my research that really this is the Donald Trump origin story. This was Donald Trump's crucible. And by this, I mean 1980s New York, in particular, the kind of tabloid culture.
Oh, yes.
Yes. This was the place where Donald Trump learned that if he could capture the public's attention and hold it, that was power, that publicity was power. And this is where he learned how to develop a storyline, right? That's what he did through the tabloids. So long before The Apprentice. Yeah.
I mean, I've always said this to people for 10 years now, and this is from my experience in New York. If you want to understand how Donald Trump operates and does this big distraction palooza every day, page 6.
Exactly.
Yep. The New York Post, 1970s and 80s.
Yep.
Donald Trump that's at the peak of his, I'm the most eligible bachelor in New York game. That's the peak of the, unquestioned ability of Trump to spin a line of garbage about anything. I'm paying for this. I'm doing that. I'm restoring Central Park. It's funny because when I got to New York to work for Giuliani in 97, I had this outsider's impression like, oh, Trump's really powerful. And immediately, and this is always ironic to me, Rudy was like, no, fuck that guy. He's an idiot. He's a fucking moron. And I'm doing my Rudy voice here a little bit, folks. He's an idiot. He's a moron. He's a jerky. He's jerky and idiotic. And literally one of the deputy mayors pipes up and goes, we throw that guy a couple parking passes a year. But other than that, he's a joke. And if you want to meet real New York real estate developers, you're going to meet him working for the boss. And I'm like,
yeah.
And I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I realized quickly, it's like you get a Bernie Mendick type guy who is like, add extra zeros on the end of the deals compared to what Trump was doing. So, that page 6 culture, man, that really shaped him, didn't it?
That's right. And the crazy thing about it is, there were there were always gossip columns in New York, right? It was,
oh, sure.
It was, you know, it had been before the 80s, it had been kind of movie stars and athletes and Broadway stars.
Right.
And, you know, suddenly in the 80s, when the city kind of pivoted around Wall Street, the greed is good era began, when America kind of started in New York,
right.
And America started to really kind of worship the culture of money and celebrity. Mm-hmm. Page Six kind of invented a new class of celebrities. And Donald Trump was the head of that class. These were bold-faced names only in a new New York and a new America that had kind of a different sense of values. And so, you know, if you were a big finance guy, if you were, you know, the head of Solomon Brothers, or if you were Donald Trump and you could, you know, you were in the, if you could kind of advocate for yourself, you could pretend to be a big shot, you were a bold-faced name.
You know, it was that transition, wasn't it? Those, it used to be the people around the tables at Elaine's and at the 21 Club were show people and older New York families and older money. And then it became maybe more vulgar, but that was a perfect fit for Trump at the time, wasn't it? I mean, it really, because he was always the kid from Queens looking in and looking up at people that he thought hated him.
Exactly.
Looked down on him, and they did.
Yep.
The old money in New York absolutely did, and still does, I guess, to the degree there is still any old money.
Yep.
All these characters, I mean, I always thought one of the big through lines in that era was race.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned Sharpton, you know, who was a big figure in that time. And we ended up at that period where we went through that whole long arc of terrible Tawana Brawley and Crown Heights and use all... And that entire arc, I mean, up until when I was there with Abner Wima and all these terrible, terrible, like the racial undercurrent in New York was a real shaping factor in what the city became in that period of time.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And the tabloids, again, you know, played a key role in that, of course, because they were this, you know, this very kind of polarizing force. And so, you know, you had a story like the Central Park Five, which, of course, Trump would end up playing his own role in.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it. And it's more than anger. It's hatred. And I want society to hate them.
In New York City in the late 80s and early 90s, the case of the Central Park jogger was notorious. In April of 1989, a white woman who had been jogging was found brutally raped and beaten nearly to death in Central Park. Not long after the woman was discovered, four black teenagers, one Latino teenager, were charged and jailed for the crime. The gruesome case whipped up an unbelievable hysteria throughout the city. The media ginning up fears with headlines about wolf packs and roving gangs and wilding. But the five boys, ages 14 to 16, had falsely confessed to the crime after hours of police interrogations. They were later tried, convicted, and sentenced to prison. But vindication for the group, known as the Central Park Five, came in 2002 when a convicted murderer and rapist confessed to the crime. And that confession was then corroborated by DNA. The prison sentences of the Central Park Five were overturned, but by that time they had already served between 5 and 13 years. In 2014, the men were awarded a $40 million settlement from New York City. The story that had gripped the city for years came to a close, and yet one Manhattan resident's obsession with the case continues to this day. Just weeks after the crime was committed in 1989, Donald Trump took out a full-page ad in four New York newspapers advocating the return of the death penalty. And when the city awarded the men a settlement in 2014, Trump wrote an editorial in the Daily News calling the settlement a disgrace. And now, even now, as a presidential nominee for the Republican Party, Trump hasn't allowed science or evidence to change his initial reaction to the case. Just this week, Trump said he still considers the men, again, exonerated by the criminal justice system and by DNA scientific evidence, guilty, issuing a statement saying, quote, they admitted they were guilty. The police doing the original investigation say they were guilty. The fact that case was settled with so much evidence against them is outrageous. The woman so badly injured will never be the same.
It was gasoline on the fire. You know, when you mentioned Rudy before, I mean, you know, after Trump took out his kind of infamous Central Park Five ad, you may remember this, but it probably predated your time with Rudy. But, you know, Trump was you know, toxic in certain quarters of the city. And at that point, you know, Rudy was running for mayor for the first time, 1989.
Yep. Yep. And 89.
He was trying to build a kind of a coalition and you know, get himself elected. Mm-hmm. And he had a fundraiser. He had already committed to having Trump be on the committee. And the whole staff was telling him beforehand, you know, you cannot be photographed with Donald Trump, whatever you do. That man is toxic.
I heard this story from Raymond Harding.
Ah, there you go. Ray Harding. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, my God, right?
It is definitely a, but that entire political change in the city,
yeah.
I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, you know, David Garth and Rudy's team in 93 and 89 and 93, successfully in 93,
what?
You know, we're selling, I'm going to clean up the city. That was a very narrowly veiled racial code.
In 1993, he was elected as the first Republican mayor of New York City since the 60s.
Hi, Rudolph William Giuliani.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Interestingly, some of his politics were pretty liberal. He supported gay rights, immigrant protections, gun control, and abortion rights. But the mayor was hyper-focused on cleaning up the city's streets. He pursued petty offenses like graffiti and marijuana possession to bring down the crime rate. But some believed this strategy was racially biased. The violent crime rate did drop during Giuliani's tenure, but it already began declining under his predecessor.
We're held together by law, and we're held together by respect for the law.
Ailes, and Ailes, you know, went to work.
Oh, yes, Ailes, right.
Ailes, yeah, Ailes had this, you know, kind of infamous line right after he took over Rudy's campaign and they were preparing for the general election against Dinkins. He said, you know, Rudy's going to get 1% of the black vote by accident. He was like, you know, this is, we know where this is going. And then sure enough, right. that's exactly where it went. You know, he immediately went after Dinkins, you know, dug up an old kind of tax, you know, failure to pay taxes scandal that was, you know, many, many years earlier. It was, you know, crime and corruption, Rudy. It was, you know.
And by the, when I got there, the city was on the uptick, you know, yep. there'd been that sort of, economic turn. Rudy did a lot to encourage it, but he also was riding a national economic uplift at the moment that, yep. you know, during the Clinton era. Yep. But it strikes me as interesting. One of the things I just thought about this in American political culture, most people have a half-life of about 15 years where yep. they're a known character. Sharpton, Giuliani, Trump, so many of these people are still in our politics and our culture every day.
It's incredible. I know.
What do you think explains that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a variety of things. One for sure is, you know, they learned how to use the media. They learned that the power that you can kind of accrue from keeping yourself in the public eye. And I think they also all, you know, and it's, you don't want to equate the three of those guys too much because they're very different characters, but they also share a sense of, well, shamelessness maybe is the best word for it. That if you don't, you know, you don't apologize, you don't back down, you just keep going, right? If you act bulletproof, you are bulletproof.
We did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And everybody knows it.
Do you owe John McCain an apology?
No, not at all, actually.
Why not say, maybe I went too far, poor choice of words, or even, I'm sorry?
I don't have to say that. Look, I can never apologize, Howard.
Yeah.
I can never apologize for the truth.
Is there anybody you'd like to apologize to right now yourself?
No.
I think they all learned that in 1980s New York in this period of time I'm writing about. And you know, that is it turns out that is kind of the secret to political success, right? I mean,
shamelessness is a superpower.
Exactly. And so I think that's, you know, I think this is where they learned it. I mean, they learned it in the kind of the tabloid culture of 1980s New York, where, you know, where you are getting ridiculed. I mean, you know, Trump too was getting mocked. He was in Page Six, you know, on a weekly, even daily basis. But he was, but you know, but he was also the target of ridicule at times too himself. And it just, you know, didn't matter. It was all publicity.
Spy magazine had more fun than the law allowed with Donald Trump during the 1980s.
What if Donald Trump were to get his own Saturday morning cartoon show?
Trump.
Donald Trump.
Yeah. And folks, I'm dating myself a bit, but if you ever go back and read the Spy magazine archives of Donald Trump stories, they will first off seem very fresh to you because of how much he bullshits then and now, but they are also just so brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. Short-fingered
vulgarian, Kurt Anderson, baby. And yeah. Graydon Carter.
The president has been unhappy with you for about 40 years.
Yes, I was an early Canadian that he was angry with. Now he's angry with the entire country. 40 years.
You did a profile of him before Vanity Fair,
yes.
Which you write about in the book.
Before Spy, actually.
Before Spy, yes. Spy magazine, which was a whole other brilliant thing that you did. And you commented on his hands.
Well, I spent 3 weeks with him. It was his first national exposure, and so he let me hang around with him. And I wrote that his cufflinks were too large and his hands were too small, and that drove him crazy. And then when we went to Spy, we had sort of funny epithets for people, and he was always a short-fingered vulgarian.
A short-fingered
vulgarian, which slightly drove him crazy over the years.
Yes. So. And yet, the hand thing, which ended up being in part of the presidential debate, he actually, before I think he was running for president, he actually has not forgotten that and sent you a note with a photograph. Didn't he?
We tried to be friends for a period and that didn't work out. And on probably the summer before he announced, he sent me a note with a 25-year-old ad for the Art of the Deal and has a photograph of him, and he circles his hand in gold Sharpie. He says, "See, quite large." And then I stapled a card to it and sent it and said, "Actually quite small," and had it hand delivered right back to
you.
I did.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the other stories in this book about how New York was changing at that time. The AIDS crisis was an enormous overlay in the early and mid 80s in New York. Talk to us about some of the stories that you profile of folks that were involved in that horrible moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So I cover these years, which are, 1986 to 1990. So the beginning of the story, AIDS is already kind of on the scene. It's already kind of begun its rampage through the city and particularly through the gay population. But it's at this point, it's starting to tip also into the Black population, to the homeless population. And along comes in 1987, a character named Larry Kramer.
He fought for bold action against HIV and for gay rights in the 1980s and 90s. Jeffrey Brown looks at his life.
Have you told them there there's an epidemic going on?
Says who?
The government.
Which government? What, our government? An epidemic.
In The Normal Heart, his 1985 play and later an HBO film, Larry Kramer wrote of love, agony, and anger in the early years of AIDS. It was the subject of much of his work as writer and activist.
Act up! Fight back! Fear rising now!
He was a founder of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and later the group ACT UP, whose public confrontations demanded attention and urgent action to address the growing AIDS crisis.
Plague! 40 million infected people is a plague! We are in the worst shape we have ever, ever been in.
He was passionate, often loud, but he was heard, including when he took on then-prominent AIDS researcher Dr. Anthony Fauci. Kramer labeled Fauci an incompetent idiot. The two would later come to mutual respect and even friendship. Today, Fauci, one of the leaders of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, spoke to Judy about Kramer.
I'm very sad that we've lost him. He is just an extraordinary man. He changed totally by his extraordinary, iconoclastic, and theatrical ways of doing things. He changed the relationship between the afflicted community with a given disease and the scientific and regulatory community that has such a great impact on them. He said, you can't be separate. You got to keep us in the tent. We've got to be in there with you.
Who is an unforgettable figure. And in many ways, you know, I call these guys gods in a, obviously not in the Judeo-Christian sense, in the Greek sense, that they are all kind of over the top with their pettiness and their wrath and their vengeance. And, you know, New York is their Mount Olympus. And in many ways, you know, Kramer is part of this pantheon too. He's not so different in certain respects from these other characters we've been talking about.
Right.
Because he realizes that he has got to bring, he needs to stir up some outrage. He needs to get confrontational. He needs to force people to pay attention to the AIDS crisis. And he does that, of course, through, you know, this kind of world-changing activist group that he forms called ACT UP. Mm-hmm. And so ACT UP is born in 1987, and over the course of the next few years, you know, becomes this really powerful force in the sort of social culture of New York, but also nationally and even globally, as it kind of finally brings attention to the AIDS crisis and forces some action from Washington. And in fact, I write about in particular about Larry Kramer's relationship with Anthony Fauci, who, you know, was kind of running the AIDS research for the country. Mm-hmm. And Kramer was absolutely vicious toward him. But yeah, ultimately Fauci kind of recognized that Kramer was more right than he was wrong, that the government did need to sort of change, did need to kind of light a fire under their AIDS research. And they reconciled, and Fauci went on to become Kramer's doctor, and they became close friends later in life.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So, you know, the city was changing so radically at that moment, and it is the money, but in some ways, I also wonder if as you wrote this, that it was some of the, it's like the death of the old neighborhood system in New York, some of that collapse of the old, you know, because when I lived in New York, I had an apartment on 81st between 1st and 2nd up in Yorkville, right? And I still could see like the memories of the German and the Hungarian neighborhoods that were around there, but that was, you know, kind of fading away. It was also the time where we started to see like the tip of the iceberg of that sort of homogenization of New York's neighborhood cultures.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you have thoughts on that, because that's something to me that it's like Americans on the outside still think New York is in weird ways more diverse than it still is, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's still ethnically diverse, right? It still has, you know, 100 different nationalities, languages, et cetera. But you're right. I mean, as kind of culturally, it has been homogenized. And I think that, you know, what a lot of what happened in the 80s is the city's kind of economic structure changed, right? New York had always been, I should not say always, but, you know, since World War II, New York had been the kind of great working class city, right? With all this kind of diverse manufacturing, shipping. Mm-hmm. It had lots of little industries. It was like the home of amazing little industries and shops and restaurants and bars. And, you know, once the sort of working class got hollowed out really by deindustrialization in the 60s and into the 70s, you know, and the city kind of was like burned to the ground in the 70s, a new city was built on those ashes. And that city that I think is the one you're talking about, you know, was the city of skyscrapers, of chain stores, of a kind of a Disneyfied Times Square, which of course had once been, you know, kind of porn shops and everything else. So, you know, it was the kind of, you know, the city just kind of bent toward kind of money and corporate interest, I think, at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. The Lululemon effect. That wasn't around then, but it certainly is striking now. You walk down, you know, Madison Avenue, and it just looks like every other high-end place you go. It's Aspen or it's Santa Barbara or whatever. It doesn't feel like this. The older city is as present as it once was. I mean, I guess you could still get that out in the boroughs, but it's not
more so. But even the boroughs are going through that same transformation.
Yeah. I mean, Brooklyn certainly. When you were writing this, did you see some of the previews of the MAGA culture that was going to emerge? And, you know, because I always look back at Staten Island and I think, God damn, that was MAGA 1.0 and nobody saw it come. Not even me.
Totally. Yeah, no. I mean, that and I have to say, you know, Trump sort of did. I mean, if you think about that Central Park Five ad,
sure,
the death penalty for these five black kids who had not even been tried yet.
Right.
And at the same time kind of indicting Koch for his failure to keep the city safe because of one, you know, kind of random crime. He, you know, you could see that he was catering to a very particular audience, to what would, you know, this,
oh, yes,
at the time he was like not a political figure at all. Mm-mm. But that was that was his base. I mean, that was what would become his base. And you see that play out in all these racial incidents in the city too. You know, when Sharpton brings black protesters into white neighborhoods and they are shouted down with the ugliest racial epithets you can possibly imagine.
Oh yeah.
What you're
Jones
seeing
Beach,
there,
Crown Heights, all those.
Exactly. What you're seeing there is like a kind of a resentment toward how the city has changed, toward a feeling that New York used to be better. There were jobs for us, you know, without those like non-college educated New Yorkers.
Right.
There was,
right.
The streets were safer. I mean, at least that's the kind of the mythos. Right. And you can see it all happening right there in 1980s New York. I mean, you can see Trump was fully aware of it. I mean, that's, and look, those are his politics today. It's almost like they're so kind of retro. It's like, it's almost hard to believe, right?
It is that, you know, somebody else explained this to me one time that it's like, do not forget that Trump is a guy from Queens.
Yes. Yeah.
Where it used to be like, keep the white in Whitestone, sort of that part of Queens.
Totally. And he grew up in this very, in particular, this real, true white enclave in Queens.
Oh, yeah.
Even as Queens was itself becoming the new kind of immigrant borough in New York,
right,
over the course of the 80s, they were in their own little enclave, this sealed off enclave that was,
yep,
you know, yep. So that's who he is. That's the essence of his identity. And, you know, remember that he and his father would not rent apartments to black
to
people.
Right.
I mean, that's his DNA.
14,000 apartments in 39 different buildings, all mostly white tenants. That is until the Department of Justice took notice in 1973 and slammed Donald Trump and his father, Fred Trump, with a lawsuit. Trump management was charged with discriminating against African Americans and breaking federal law. Donald Trump, then just 27, was president of the company.
The Department of Justice accused the Trumps of violating the Fair Housing Act, arguing they were turning away renters based on race and color. Who tipped them off? Local activists, so-called testers, posing as potential renters at Trump's buildings, mainly in Brooklyn and Queens.
Elise Goldweber was a lawyer for the DOJ's Fair Housing section at the time and was called on to handle the Trump case.
When the black testers came, they were shown, they may have been shown apartments, but were told nothing was available. Whereas when the white testers came, yes, there were things that were available. That would be the norm.
And if the Trumps did rent to a black person, Goldweber recalls, they would do so only at one building in Brooklyn, reserving the other buildings for white tenants.
That the white people would live in Trump Village and the people of color would live in Flatbush.
And according to the Justice Department, they even had a secret coding system to do it, a racial code. Here's how.
Some of the applications were marked with a C, which we learned that it meant colored, so that the prospective tenants who had come in were noted to be colored.
Yes, you heard her right. The Department of Justice alleged applications submitted by prospective African-American renters were designated with a secret code, such as C for colored, to indicate a black person was looking to rent. In true Trump fashion, Donald Trump hit back, calling the government's accusations absolutely ridiculous and telling the court, "I have never, nor has anyone in my organization ever, to the best of my knowledge, discriminated or shown bias in the renting of our apartments."
Trump's lawyer said the government suit failed to give names, addresses, or specific incidences of discrimination. Claiming the lawsuit caused substantial damage to their business and reputation, Trump took the most unusual step of suing the Justice Department for defamation, seeking $100 million in damages. But that countersuit was tossed out by the judge. Even so, the Trump family maintained they never discriminated based on color, but were instead trying to avoid renting to people on welfare. 2 years later, in 1975, Trump and his father settled the case, agreeing not to discriminate against anyone. They also promised to advertise in publications aimed at minorities, familiarize themselves with the details of the Fair Housing Act, and notify civil rights groups of apartment vacancies. The Department of Justice claimed victory, but the Trumps never admitted any wrongdoing, reportedly noting the settlement was in no way an admission of a violation.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, I think a lot of people are they look at Trump, they go, oh, he's from New York. He's got to be more sophisticated than that. He's got to be more empathetic than that. He's got to be more. And I'm like, no, yeah. That's not where he's from.
That's
he
right.
may live in a golden tower in Midtown, but or near Central Park, but he is from what basically was as white as you know, a affluent Birmingham, Alabama suburb in New York. And it shaped him. I think, you know, Fred was a pretty bad guy in terms of that stuff as well. So you know, I think he learned, I think part of what Trump came to do was associate using the word luxury with using the word white. You know, these are luxury apartments. They won't be here.
That's right. That's
you know, right out of Fred's playbook. What else from the 80s do you think really shaped New York as it is today and shaped? And I do think this book is interesting because it does. There's such a big footprint on the rest of American culture from what happened in New York right in that window.
I mean, another huge thing that was happening then was that New York in those years became the center of global capitalism, right? This mm-hmm. is where globalization kind of and sure. globalism begins in New York in the 1980s as kind of technology allows Wall Street to start become this kind of international phenomenon.
This is the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the nerve center of American capitalism.
I think 1987 was the beginning of a new Wall Street. It had been different. It had been kind of a pinstripe Yale, Harvard graduates who ran the old banking houses. And then suddenly they were hiring a lot of people who had street smarts, but not necessarily trained in economics. And they were currency traders, or they were stock traders, and it was going 24/7.
With us for over 10 years. He came to us out of high school. This is his first job. And Bob Modis is working for the senior fellow over here, Arthur Rhinand, who's been in the business since 1959. Came to the securities business right after the Navy.
So you can take someone who doesn't not necessarily have a business school background and make him a good trader?
I think you can, yes. But it really is more of a feel for the market, more of a personality than it is a formal education.
I remember a young woman at a trading desk. She was currency trading. She had a Ferrari, a picture of a Ferrari on her trading console. That was her objective.
What do you get out of this? What's the big kick?
I guess,
Eddie.
Making a lot of money.
It was rock and roll. You could see money driving everything. A lot of cocaine around, a lot of party hardy every night.
The old guard, it took them years and years, and new people on Wall Street, they want to do it in 2 days.
I don't say that Wall Street was always the paragon of morality before they all arrived. There have been scandals over the years and people who had, in their own way, manipulated the system for their own benefit. But now you had so many people doing, and the rewards were so great.
Wall Street is in a continuing state of shock as a result of the greatest scandal in its history.
In America, one of the great things about this nation is that we can seek profit. And I'm proud of that. If you can gain profit, that's even better.
That was Ivan Boesky a couple of years ago. Before investigators caught up with him, he had been known on Wall Street as King of the Arbs, a big-time arbitrageur who invested in stocks of companies he thought were going to be taken over.
Some of the smartest and most respected traders on the street have been led from their prestigious firms by federal law enforcement authorities. One was even led away in handcuffs.
You know, the Wall Street people, whatever else we think about them, are very canny, and they make quick judgments, and they're tough about what they're doing. And they generally pick up on who seems to be gaming the system because they're making more money than they would otherwise. Boesky was a classic example of that.
If Boesky was greedy, so are a lot of other people on Wall Street. Since 1984, there have been more than 48 cases of insider trading, many involving the financial community, brought by New York's U.S. attorney, Rudolph Giuliani.
I can't say that I saw it coming, but it was what started then that led to the collapse of Bear Stearns, led to the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And now we see, in the course of the last 30-some years, how it has changed Wall Street. Great wealth has been accumulated by many of these young people who became hedge fund traders and other things. But in too many instances, they parked their moral compass at the door.
So you see, you know, so that is sort of critical. And then again, the sort of backlash you see against that in the outer boroughs is that is like a microcosm of what we have seen in our nation over the last decade. This idea of like the globalized economy, there are no jobs for the working class. It's a system that favors the elites, the wealthy, and others are left out and become resentful. And sure. So that is what happened in New York in the 80s, and that is what then kind of swept across our country over the subsequent decades. The amazing thing is that Trump, who was in the 1980s, was the personification of greed and of excess and of money, somehow through some crazy magic trick, kind of reinvented himself, or right, without losing that
as
identity,
the working class hero,
as the voice of all the people who felt left out of this transformation. So you see that transformation first in New York in the 1980s. All the seeds of it are there, and then it just rolls across the country. I think it's a, you know, like the misconception about Trump and The Apprentice. I think there's a misconception that America, that it was NAFTA and deregulation under Clinton, et cetera, that started this sort of the backlash against globalization. I think you can go back further to 1980s New York to see like its real roots.
I think that is the most fascinating part of this book is that particular case that New York in that moment shaped our culture, and it's hard to say that it shaped our culture at other times, you know, certainly other times, but this seems so consequential, and that long running knock on effect almost 45 years later.
Yeah.
Which makes me feel old as shit.
No, it is crazy. It's the same. It's the knock on effect and the same cast of characters. It's like that. Yeah.
It is quite something. Well, it's a tremendous book, folks. Jonathan Mahler's The Gods of New York, absolutely a banger. It is such a window into how a culture shaped and continues to shape our politics right now. Thanks so much, everybody, for tuning in to the Lincoln Project podcast today. Jonathan, tell folks where they can find you online and tell them about your day job, where they can read your other stuff.
Yeah. So my day job is at the New York Times. I'm a writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And, you know, you can buy The Gods of New York anywhere. You can buy it at your local bookstore. You can buy it on Amazon. You can also follow me on Twitter or on Instagram. But most importantly, go out and buy the book. It's great.
Go buy the book, folks. It's a good one. It's a banger. So, hey, Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate you, man.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I really appreciate it.
And good luck.